News.
This is Metro Connection. I'm David First. We all know the economic crisis has hit the business world hard. Some businesses have instituted salary and hiring freezes to cut costs. Others have gone through rounds of layoffs. Still others have shut their doors completely. And things don't look much better in the nonprofit sector. In a recent survey of 1,500 nonprofit organizations in the D.C. area, nearly half say they expect to freeze salaries this coming year. A quarter plan to freeze various programs. In fact, although many analysts are declaring an end to the worst U.S. recession since the Great Depression, many nonprofits in the region fear the worst is yet to come. Rebecca Shear reports.
In a brightly painted classroom in Northwest D.C., Lindsay Buss is having breakfast with a gaggle of 3- and 4-year-olds.
How's that waffle?
Okay, so the early morning entrees are actually toys.
Nothing like a good plastic waffle breakfast.
But a real breakfast will be served in just a few minutes. Buss is president of Martha's Table, a nonprofit providing low-income families in D.C. with support services like this daycare for toddlers, as well as roughly 500,000 meals each year.
But this year has been a challenge for us. The number of people coming for food is more than doubled and almost tripled. We're averaging 550 people coming for emergency groceries in a month. And that's in addition to the people who are served by our daily meal program.
But here's the thing. Buss predicts 2010 will be even worse.
Because even as the recovery settles in, the last people it's going to hit are the people at the bottom of the economic chain. And resources that support nonprofits, from individual giving foundations to government, don't show signs that they're going to recover by 2010.
As we look to 2010, even though the markets are beginning to come back up, it's possible people's money will continue to be down.
Julie Rogers runs the Meyer Foundation, which is dedicated to supporting Washington's nonprofit leaders. People like Lindsay Buss, who recently won the foundation's $100,000 Exponent Award.
There are additional stresses on leaders. They're having to do multiple budgets. They have to do contingency planning with their boards. They're worried constantly about cash flow and how they're going to meet payroll on Fridays.
Not to mention how they're going to meet the needs of their clients every day. A situation, incidentally, which Jonathan Smith, another Exponent winner, has come to know all too well. As executive director of the Legal Aid Society,
we provide representation to district residents who live in poverty regarding a range of civil matters.
Smith has seen such a surge in need, he's had to turn many people away.
We're working extremely hard to try to do more with less, but are able to do so.
Smith and his staff are strategizing on how to keep weathering the financial storm. He says they're exploring alternate funding sources and trying to align their priorities with changing client demands. Still, he thinks it'll be 2011 before the skies even start to clear.
What have you got? You want some pancakes?
Lindsay Buss of Martha's Table agrees, though he does see a glimmer of light right here in front of him.
As you see the kids thriving here, this is the stuff that inspires you to find the solutions. We want to make sure that we're in a position to continue to provide these services and to help these children grow.
And kicking off the day with a good square meal.
Yum, yum.
A non-plastic one, of course, is a great way to start. I'm Rebecca Shear.
As the economy tumbled over the last year, immigrants in the Washington area felt the effects like everyone else. But the impact has gone beyond their own pocketbooks all the way to the countries they came from. Many in Washington's large immigrant community send money to the families they left behind. The families have come to rely on these remittances, but work is scarce, so remittances are down substantially. Kate Sheehy went to D.C.'s Columbia Heights neighborhood to see how Latino immigrants there are faring.
Mara Hernandez is a teacher at the Barbara Chambers Children's Center. Her 19 preschool-age students are from various Latin American backgrounds. Hernandez came to the U.S. from Mexico 15 years ago and is now a permanent resident. Since her husband lost his job almost a year ago, Hernandez says she can't pay for the medical care her mother needs in Mexico.
And now I'm sending less money to my mommy. She needs an operation because she's sick. I can't send more money to her.
Maribel Ventura is the director of the Children's Center. She comes outside to visit with parents as they pick up their kids at the end of the day.
Many families have come to request, to reduce the fee they pay for their children because they have been lost their jobs or the hours have been reduced.
Ventura also has had to cut back on the money she sends to family in El Salvador because her salary has been cut. And the economy's toll is not just financial. A little farther north at 14th and Perry Place, Miguel Urarte, a native of Bolivia, works as an addictions counselor in the Latino community with an organization called Andromeda.
Hola, Juan. Bienvenido.
80% of his clients are Salvadorans. He says the number of clients has almost doubled in the last year.
If they cannot find jobs, they start drinking or using drugs.
Uriarte says about 50% of his clients are illegal immigrants. They tell him they're thinking about going back home.
De maravilla. Bien.
And some people have left. Jose Argueta is standing outside a small store called Peggy's North of the Border, across the street from Andromeda.
So many people is going back to El Salvador.
He says some of his own family members went back home because they lost their jobs, but he's going to stay. He wants to start a new business. That doesn't surprise Manuel Orozco. He works for the Inter-American Dialogue, a not-for-profit think tank that studies U.S. relations with Latin America. Orozco says it's true that remittances are down. He worked on a report showing an 11% drop in 2009. But he says that doesn't mean people will really leave the United States.
They're thinking about it more because the economy is not as well, or that they feel that the society in general is blaming them for the problems of the crisis. People don't really have plans to go back.
We make pupusas, taquitos.
Someone like Jose Reyes wouldn't even consider leaving. He came to the United States from El Salvador in the 1980s. He opened his restaurant El Tamarindo about 30 years ago and now has two locations. His friend Guillermo Alvarado interprets for him.
I came to this country because I come from a very poor family, and I heard that in the United States you can make money, get better, and prepare to be a better person.
Reyes, now a U.S. citizen, says business has gradually gotten slower, especially in the last few months, but he has not let go of any employees or cut wages.
I have a lot of faith that we're going to work together and we're going to take this economy up again, and we have to work hard to make that happen.
But for the time being, people like Mara Hernandez remain skeptical. She says her brother is desperate for money in Mexico and wants to come to the U.S.
I say to him, stay there, don't come. If I have a little bit money, I will send you. But don't come.
Manuel Orozco says as the economy bounces back, so will the demand for immigrant labor. And maybe in time, Mara Hernandez will change her mind about what to tell her brother. For Metro Connection, I'm Kate Sheehy.
And to see this story in photos, go to metroconnection.org. At 14 minutes past the hour, this is Metro Connection on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5's coverage of the environment comes from the Wallace Genetic Foundation, serving the Washington area through the promotion of farmland preservation, natural resource conservation, and environmental education. Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the University of Phoenix, because an educated world is a better world. More information online at phoenix.edu.
With all things considered, you can turn your ride home into an escape, exploring a world beyond the headlines. All Things Considered finds stories you haven't heard, interesting perspectives, innovative ideas, and voices beyond the ordinary. Join us for something new and unexpected every afternoon. It's All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered every weeknight from 4 to 8 on WAMU 88.5.
WAMU and the Phillips Collection are giving away tickets to see Man Ray, African Art in the Modernist Lens exhibition on view now. More information is at WAMU.org under calendar. Partly sunny skies and 57 degrees in Northwest Washington at 116.
This is Metro Connection. I'm David First. Coming up, the Redskins trademark survives the Supreme Court, and the Washington Blade shuts down. But before that, slots casinos are due to open in Maryland next year, and electronic table games will likely be part of the equation. Commentator Fred Fisk says it's just a matter of time before real live versions of games like blackjack and roulette follow.
The people who run the gambling industry are a heck of a lot smarter than most of us. A few years ago, when they sought authorization in Maryland to open gambling casinos like those in Las Vegas and Atlantic City, considerable opposition developed. Many opponents, including me, argued that it would be unwise and unbecoming for a state to generate revenue based on gambling, that it generally led to crime and corruption of various sorts and to a variety of social ills. Many of us thought that it was immoral to place the burden of raising state revenue on the backs of the poor and those who may be addicted to gambling. The industry overcame the opposition by restricting their proposals to a few slot machine parlors and argued that without the revenue from them, school budgets would have to be cut. Well, you know the rest of the story. Slots were approved, but not blackjack, roulette, or other table games. The state authorized 5 venues for the slots, and they're due to start operating next year. That, my friends, was a foot in the door for the gambling industry. They now argue that to attract players, they'll have to be competitive with casinos in nearby states, and they'd like to include electronic versions of the banned games, which they say are not susceptible to fraud and crime. It's likely that it will be approved, and you can bet that the next step will be to argue that for the new casinos to be competitive, they'll have to include those banned games. I hope that before that happens, some Maryland lawmakers will take a look at what's happened in Atlantic City and Las Vegas. Atlantic City was Boomtown, USA, a few years ago. Today, it's in a death spiral. 3 of the town's 11 casinos are under bankruptcy protection. Thousands of slot machines stand idle. Thousands of workers who served hotel and casino customers are out of work. And New Jersey legislators are looking for ways to replace the tax revenue, which supported programs for the elderly and the disabled. Even Las Vegas has learned that the gambling industry is not recession-proof. Many of the luxury hotels built during the boom times are now largely empty during the week, and plans for casino enlargement and construction have all been shelved. Gambling operations in Atlantic City and Las Vegas have been hurt by the competition in Indiana, in Pennsylvania, in the New York area, in Connecticut. Mark my words, after the electronic game casinos start operating next year, the gambling operators will start to pressure state lawmakers to allow live games to compete with casinos in nearby states. And because the state will have become dependent on casino taxes, they'll very likely accommodate the industry. The promises and the predictions that the industry is making in Maryland now are similar to those made in Atlantic City and Las Vegas. The experience demonstrates how unwise it is to look to gambling as a source of revenue. While the virtual games starting next year are a foot in the door, don't be surprised a few years from now to find an elephant in the room. This is Fred Fisk.
On Monday, the Supreme Court refused to hear a case brought by a group of Native American activists. This was the challenge to the name, the Washington Redskins. The activists argued that the team name was too offensive to stand as a trademark. We're joined by the attorney for the activists, Philip Moss. He's a partner at Drinker, Biddle & Reith in Washington. Welcome.
Good to chat with you.
This was a tough decision for you and your clients. Was this expected?
Well, we were petitioning for cert, and cert is always a long shot because the Supreme Court just gets such a large volume of cert petitions. We were hopeful that we had a shot here, and we're disappointed, but we certainly were not counting on getting cert.
The Supreme Court did not decide this case based on the issue of whether this trademark is offensive or not. The original decision that was handed up to the Supreme Court was that the activists had waited too long to take legal action, and the Supreme Court decided just not to get involved?
That's right. The decision of the D.C. Circuit was that the doctrine of laches is applicable to this kind of case, and in this particular case, the petitioners had waited too long.
The doctrine of laches, that sounds like the name of some new mystery novel. Can you tell us exactly what that means?
It is somewhat similar to the more familiar notion of a statute of limitations. It is a doctrine that when you have a right to bring an action against somebody, if you wait too long, then you can be barred by the doctrine of laches.
The magic number in all of this seems to be 18.
Well, 18 is an important age because that's the age of majority in most states. That's the age at which you could commence a legal action on your own behalf. And so the D.C. Circuit has held that that is the age of the start time. The time starts running in determining what the delay period is for a particular petitioner who brings a petition of this type. So if you're 18 on a certain date and you bring a petition 10 years later, the delay period is 10 years.
Let me make sure I understand this. If you don't decide to take legal action against any company, any trademark, when you're 18 years old, you can forget about it?
Well, on the ground, if there's an existing trademark out there that you think disparages you or some group that you're a part of, you wait too long after you're 18. And the question of what is too long is a question of fact in each particular case. Yes, then you can be barred from that kind of action. That's what the D.C. Circuit held. That's what the decision we were trying to challenge in the Supreme Court. That is the opposite of what the Third Circuit held. The Third Circuit held that laches does not apply to this kind of case.
Everyone knows when you turn 18, the very first thing on your mind is trademark law.
That's right. When I was 18 years of age, my parents held a party for me, but I was unable to attend because I actually became 18 at 7 in the evening. So I had the Patent and Trademark Office stay open that evening so I could go down and review all the trademarks to see if there's any that disparage me, because I'm very sensitive to that because of the mispronunciation of my last name.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was satisfied that at that time there weren't any such trademarks.
Well, I wish we could all be like you and take action on that very day.
Well, that's essentially what the respondents to the petition are suggesting that everybody should do.
Mm-hmm. So assuming that the magic number is 18, it follows that, hey, you get a bunch of 18-year-olds to file the next suit. And it so happens that your firm is also representing another group of activists that are filing suit. And these guys are younger?
Yeah, there's a group of six Native Americans who filed a petition in 2006. And they were at that time ranged in age, I think, between 18 and about 21. And we're hopeful that they will be able to avoid the laches doctrine because they filed pretty quickly after they reached the age of majority.
So where is this headed, Philip? Will the courts eventually have to decide on the main issue here?
Yes, the courts are ultimately going to have to decide this on the merits, and I'm confident that we will win on the merits when it's decided on the merits. The argument is it's disparaging to a group of Americans, Native Americans. The Lanham Act specifically states that disparaging terms should not be registered as trademarks. And the evidence is pretty strong that the term redskin is a disparaging term for Native Americans. We're all familiar with a number of disparaging terms for various American groups. This is a disparaging term for Native Americans.
The original petition was filed in 1992. So when is it going to be? When is this going to be decided?
Well, that's a very good question. It takes quite a while for these cases to go forward. I think our opponents have every desire to delay the inevitable as long as possible, but I'm hopeful that we can move the new case along pretty quickly, hopefully by using the record in the prior case and getting pretty quickly to a decision so that we can get this resolved.
Well, the team, the athletes, managed to pull off a victory this past weekend. Are you a fan of the football team, the Washington Redskins?
Yeah, I'm a fan, and I've lived here since the '70s, and I can remember the first Joe Gibbs era, and we really loved them, and love the players now. It's nothing against the team; it's just the name.
Would you be able to show your face in public if you're the guy that removes the official name, Washington Redskins?
You know, there are people within the law firm, within my family, who disagree with the case. So we just do our best. I'm a lawyer. I do believe in the cause, but there is a disagreement about this. I would say this. I think that the public sentiment on this issue, as reflected, you know, when I'm on shows and people call in, when people talk to me about it, emails I get, editorials, the public sentiment on this issue is coming around to the notion that the name has to be changed.
Well, Philip Moss, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Philip Moss is a partner at Drinker, Biddle & Reith in the District. The Washington Blade, the oldest newspaper in the U.S. for gays and lesbians, was abruptly closed on Monday by Atlanta-based Window Media, along with other gay publications in Atlanta and Miami. But the paper has already been reborn as the D.C. Agenda. The first issue is out today. Kevin Naff, the former editor of The Blade and new editor of The Agenda, says it's critical that the work continues. Speaking with Kavitha Cardoza, he explains why he believes the mission is so important.
There just aren't many outlets left that are doing what we do. People have a false notion about this new acceptance of LGBT people. We're fortunate to be in Washington, D.C., where we have openly gay members of the city council and a mayor who wants to sign a marriage bill, and that's all great. But that's not the reality for the vast majority of this country. We have to remember that, you know, after 40 years of trying, we just got the very first LGBT-related federal bill passed and signed into law by President Obama just a few weeks ago, the hate crimes bill. I speak to a lot of youth groups, and the students are always struck by how much bigotry is still out there. They grew up with Will and Grace in the living room, and they think that this level of acceptance, if you want to put it that way, has always been there, and it hasn't. This is all very new, this gay marriage thing that's happening.
I was going to ask you whether, as a journalist and editor, you were worried about missing a big story, which is the same-sex marriage vote in December. But I guess that's not a concern now.
We've got multiple bills that are working their way through Congress. There's a markup on the domestic partnership bill in Congress. We will be there covering it, assuming that they honor our press credentials and let us in. We'll find out. There are a lot of stories we've been following that we will now continue to follow under this new entity. I can't imagine us not being around to cover these momentous events. We are the movement is just on the cusp of so many huge advances. And I think going forward, we will certainly look at what happened to The Blade. There are parts of it that remain a mystery even to me. It's very confusing, involving multiple companies and government entities and bankruptcy courts and trustees, and it's going to take some sorting out, but we will endeavor to do that because, you know, personally, I'm angry. I have anger about all of this, but I don't know where to direct it. So I'd like to find out where it should be directed. So we'll, now that we're freed of the corporate entity, we can do that.
So what's happened to the 40 years of the Washington Blade? Like, what's happened to all the papers?
The archive is extensive, and it's really one-of-a-kind stuff. These are not events that, you know, the Associated Press would have covered back in the 70s or 80s. These were, you know, our community events. So all of the early gay pride celebrations in Washington, all of that material is there. The early days of the AIDS epidemic and all of the protests that were happening and all of the local people who died, all of that is all locked up in our old offices in the National Press Building, in a hallway of filing cabinets. And it's currently owned by the bankruptcy court. The bankruptcy court will appoint a trustee to presumably sell the assets. My fear, of course, is that a trustee who walks into that office and sees a row of filing cabinets might think it's trash and just get rid of it. It would just kill me for 40 years of our history to end up in a landfill. So what we really need is for somebody to come forward with some cash to buy the archive and then donate it to a university or a historical society, somewhere that will preserve it and make it accessible to the public again. More recently, from about 2002 to now, all of the material is online, you know, databased. That was pulled offline and is now sitting somewhere on a server farm. It would be really nice to have access to all of those thousands of stories again.
You were editor of the Washington Globe, but you also had a very personal connection to it.
I first encountered the Blade like a lot of young gay people in Washington. I walked into Lambda Rising as a teenager, not knowing anything about the community or anything about being what it meant to be gay, and found the Blade and picked it up and discovered there was a whole world out there that I knew nothing about, which was intimidating but also comforting to know that I wasn't alone, that there was a life, you know, waiting for me. And I hear those stories all the time, and I hear them today. There are a lot of older gay men in particular who are coming out now after having gone through marriages and had children and realized late in life that they're gay, or just now finding the courage to come out. And they're going into Lambda Rising at 40 and 50 and 60 years old and picking up the paper for the first time and discovering this community. So it's a tremendous loss, but I think it's also a time of tremendous opportunity. We are united, we are focused, and we're going to come back and carry on the mission of the paper.
Kevin Naff, the former editor of the Washington Blade and the new editor of the DC Agenda, speaking with Kavitha Cardoza. The first issue of the DC Agenda is out today. For more information and for a link to the new website, you can visit metroconnection.org. Coming up, grab a napkin and pull up a chair. Food writer Tim Carman is ready to talk tacos. At 34 minutes past the hour, this is Metro Connection on WAMU 88.5.
With water found on the moon, is it time to rethink inhabiting the lunar surface? I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday for a conversation with Mark Sykes, head of the Planetary Science Institute. Plus advances in tropical medicine and the latest on do-it-yourself solar power. That's on Science Friday from NPR News.
Coming up in 25 minutes here on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Navigation Arts, driving business value by optimizing the online user experience, internet strategy, information architecture, and web content management. Navigation Arts, architects of the user experience, on the web at navigationarts.com. From Catholic University School of Law, presenting critical insights in the law and law practice, a year-long four-part discussion on legal ethics at the National Press Club. Details at law.edu.
He's taken on burgers, hot dogs, Philly cheesesteaks. Food writer Tim Carman turns his attention and his iron stomach to tacos today, specifically where to find the best tacos in the D.C. region. Tim writes about food for the Washington City Paper. Welcome back.
Thanks, David.
And we're going to be talking about where to find the best tacos, but also about a few newcomers to the taco arena.
It says something about the economy. Tacos, you know, cheap, flavorful, easy, not a lot of overhead. So it's not surprising, I think, that we're seeing a kind of influx of taquerias. I mean, who doesn't love a taco? We've all been probably been eating them since, what, age six when we had our first hard shell taco stuffed with ground beef and Kraft cheddar, shredded cheddar cheese over the top.
If you're trying to pick one taco over another, what makes a good taco?
Well, the ones we were just talking about, those kind of crispy shell with the cumin-scented beef, those are classic kind of Tex-Mex tacos. That's not what we're talking about here. These are more inspired, if not downright imitative of classic Mexican tacos. By classic Mexican tacos, I would say they're real corn tortillas, you know, often two-ply around a filling. And the filling can be many different variations, but then simply garnished. And the classic Mexican garnish is just diced onions, cilantro, and some salsa. Now, Americans, we like abundance. So, you know, we have many variations on the simple Mexican taco, and you can see it on the low end and you can see it on the high end. The more upscale versions I find, like at Oyamel, you know, they're doing some fairly nice cuts of meat, and they're braising them in really flavorful, savory liquids until all the texture is taken out. Now, I have no problem. They do very fine tacos there, but there's not that sort of texture that you will find in a sort of classic, gritty Mexican taqueria.
So there's a lot of different approaches to taco making and a lot of different ways you can be successful making tacos. Let's talk about some of the newcomers in town.
There's three that we'll talk about, and there's one that I haven't been to yet that I'm dying to try. But the first one on the list is over on 8th Street Northeast in what's now called the Atlas District.
Ah, yes, the H Street Country Club.
This is a combination taqueria and miniature golf course. And the miniature golf course is really kind of fun. But the taqueria was inspired by and assisted by Ann Cashin, who's got her own taqueria up on Capitol Hill called Taqueria Nacional. Fabulous taqueria. So she had a hand in kind of creating the menu. And they do, I would say, you know, a fairly classic Mexican version, but it's pretty simple. They do just a single-ply tortilla with either beef or pork and some chopped cilantro on top.
And it goes nicely with mini golf.
I guess so. Who would have thunk it?
So the H Street Country Club, a good taco?
I would say it's average to above average. I think the meats are good. I think they're a little too simple. They have decent salsas, but it suffers from what a lot of different tacos around the area suffer from, which is not a fresh tortilla. It's not that they're bad. There's actually some very good commercial tortillas, but there's also some that just don't have much flavor. And even worse, they're not very moist and they dry out. And pretty soon all your fillings are falling all over your plate and you just need a fork and you're not even having a taco anymore. You're just eating meat off a plate with a little bit of side bite of tortilla.
Tortilla shrapnel on the plate.
Exactly.
So hovering around par at the H Street Country Club?
Hovering, I would say, plus one or plus two.
Plus one or plus two. Okay, what's next?
Yes, they need to get a club pro in there.
Okay.
The other place is this new joint off DuPont Circle called Tomatilla Taqueria. This is only a lunchtime operation. It's open from like 11:30 to 2 p.m. Monday through Friday. And they do both burritos and tacos. But it's kind of interesting because, you know, you don't think about street food around DuPont Circle, but this is kind of a modified version of street food. They're using just the front window of the club called the Big Hunt. I like the tacos. He does kind of a nice braised bottom round beef, and he does a very flavorful chicken leg or chicken thigh, I believe it is. The main issue I think I have with the Tomatillo Taqueria tacos is that he's got salsas, and they're very hot, like you find them down in Mexico. The Mexican salsas are very hot, but they know how to use them, and you can kind of garnish them the way you want. Because he puts your tacos together for you, he often puts it on a little too heavy, so then it's too hot.
Okay, so a little too hot to handle at the Tomatillo Taqueria.
I would say, you know, if you get the salsas, particularly the habanero one, just make sure that it's an accent. And which salsas should be? Salsa always should just be an accent. It shouldn't be the dominant flavor.
The Tomatillo Taqueria by DuPont Circle?
Correct.
Okay, we have time for one more newcomer.
There's one in Adams Morgan called Pica Taco. It's owned by a woman, and she opened this up in kind of the bottom of an apartment complex at 1629 Columbia Road Northwest. She does really some very decent tacos, again, using a commercial tortilla, which she warms up in kind of a sandwich press. The absolute best taco that she does there is, believe it or not, it's the one that talks back to you. It's the lengua.
The lengua, the tongue.
Yes.
Okay.
She knows how to slow cook beef tongue. Sometimes beef tongue can be too chewy for my taste, and she slow cooks it in a way that it's almost like foie gras. Great savory flavor, real good tomatillo sauce. Altogether, that's probably one of the best tacos I've had around in this town.
Huh, one of the best tacos. But if you don't feel like dancing into the realm of trying a beef tongue taco, how about the less intimidating varieties?
Well, I think she does a good barbacoa, too. So, I mean, if you're really not in the mood for eating tongue or, you know, dealing with that texture or even the psychological aspects of eating a cow tongue, go with the barbacoa.
Okay, that's Pica Taco in Adams Morgan. And you mentioned there's another new place that you haven't tried yet.
Yeah, and I'm dying to try it. It's called District Taco. It's a taco truck. It's a taco stand over in the Roslyn area, kind of at Wilson Boulevard and North Lynn Street. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what they've got going over there, because that's an unusual place to stick a taco truck.
Okay, we've heard about some taco newcomers. Tim Carman, what about the ultimate tacos in the D.C. region?
Well, you know, this one's new to me, and I should probably be embarrassed that I haven't been here earlier, but there's a place up in Hyattsville in kind of the corridor often known as Little Mexico. You know, there's a number of taquerias along there, but one that I just learned about and just started going there just a few weeks ago is a place called La Placita. They only do tacos. It's this wonderful environment. It's this little taqueria off Bladensburg Road. You go in there and the music's loud and they've got murals on the walls and all they do are tacos. They do every kind of meat you can imagine. I mean, you want tongue, you're going to get your tongue. You want ear, you want a pig's ear, you'll get a pig's ear taco.
You want ear, you came to the right place.
That's right. I know, David, you tend to look for ear when you go to your taqueria.
First thing I look for.
Short ribs, they do short ribs. You know, pretty much any sort of cut you can imagine, you will find it, even head meat. And that's the interesting thing about this place. It is almost like a walk through the different flavors and textures of cuts of beef and cuts of pork. You really get to appreciate the different textures, the different flavors of different cuts of meat. And there's a real art to that, an art in cooking it and an art of presenting it and really appreciating it too. That's what makes it such an enjoyable experience to go over there, is not only the atmosphere that you're in, but all this wealth of tacos. You're not just talking about a savory braise of a certain meat that kind of takes away all the textures and kind of imparts the flavor of whatever cooking liquid you might have in there, but you're talking about a real individualistic flavors of each cut, and that's what I love about it.
It may sound like a vegetarian's nightmare to walk into that atmosphere, but is there a vegetarian option there? And you have to say that there's something to be said with using all of the animal and not having some of the cuts go to waste.
Totally. It's nose-to-tail cooking way before it became trendy. You know, and as far as the vegetarian option, I don't recall.
Drawing a blank there.
Yes. I'm sorry, vegetarians. Publicly flogged here.
We'll twist your arm again next time for some more vegetarian options.
There is one, however, if you are looking for a vegetarian taco, there is one at Tomatillo Taqueria off DuPont Circle.
All right, and you're saying this is really the ultimate tacos in town here. The name of the place, La Placita, where is it located?
Taqueria La Placita is located at 5020 Edmonston Road in Hyattsville, which is this little road off of Bladensburg Road. Great atmosphere. Great food. They do commercial tortillas, too. I asked them about it because I could have swore these were freshly made tortillas. They were so flavorful, and they puffed up, which is really one of the defining characteristics of a good taco is, you know, you look for that slightly puffy, very fresh corn flavor, and theirs had it. They actually showed me the bag. whoever bought these has a really incredible palate because these are really great tortillas. And they warm them up on the griddle, which, you know, is kind of seasoned. Particularly if you go there later in the day, it's got some nice seasoning on it, so it gets picks up a little bit of the grease from the grill, and it puffs up nicely, and it just creates this beautiful little handheld bite.
That's La Placita, not using fresh tortillas, but finding a way to make it taste like they're fresh tortillas. And the location is 5020 Edmonston Road in Hyattsville. For more information on all of the restaurants that Tim mentioned, you can go to our website. Just go to metroconnection.org. Tim Carman, good to see you again.
Good to see you, David.
Tim Carman is the food columnist for the Washington City Paper. And from tacos, we jump to edible art, or at least artwork that was inspired by food. Edible plants are not just in the produce section of your local supermarket. They're all around us. You just have to know where to look. One Northern Virginia artist has become a self-taught expert on foraging for wild plants in Arlington. Not only does he make a lot of salad, it's a hobby that set his artistic efforts off in a new direction. Mike Jansen reports.
Matthew Best doesn't have to travel far from his studio at the Arlington Arts Center to find inspiration for his art. He just walks downstairs and out the front door.
I was here for maybe a year before I ever even noticed the mulberries, and then last spring I first saw them. So I started to come out here and pick them.
In addition to mulberries, Best also points out service berries, a kind of berry that looks and tastes like a blueberry. There's also greenbrier growing over a fence. It's a tart and lemony vine that Best picks and adds to his salads. This is what it's like to walk through the suburbs of Northern Virginia with Best as a guide. Look around and food is hiding in plain sight, in the form of edible wild plants. Since moving to Northern Virginia 2 years ago, the 35-year-old artist has taught himself to recognize dozens of varieties of plants and prepare them for eating. The hobby has added variety to his diet. It's also transformed his art.
This was one time I found a pawpaw in the forest, so I just did a quick drawing of what I saw that day. Or another time I was trying to identify a plant. It got a little messy, but I wrote down where I found it and kind of identifying things about it. So it's what its stem was like, its leaves, what it smelled like at times. So it turned into like sketchbook after sketchbook after sketchbook. And then these drawings kind of started filtering into my paintings.
In his studio at the Art Center, Best flips through a box of pocket-sized sketchbooks that he's used to document his foraging excursions. He credits his interest in foraging in part to the popular book The Omnivore's Dilemma by journalist Michael Pollan, which features a chapter on edible wild plants. Best also started foraging as a way to feel more at home in Northern Virginia after moving here from Massachusetts.
When I first moved here, I felt very disconnected from everything because I grew up in New England and it's more... There's trees and it's quieter and there's less people. And I moved here and I felt very overwhelmed and I was completely out of it. I couldn't function here for the first few months that I was here. So I wasn't entirely happy when I first lived here, and then kind of finding more familiar places to me in particular. And then I always joke, almost literally eating Virginia. So like eating things that are directly out of the land of found in Virginia, the parks and things, I felt this weird connection to it. So it was almost like making it part of me in a strange way.
This year, 172 pages from Best's sketchbooks were included in a show in Missouri, where they were arranged on a wall in a grid-like fashion. The influence of Best's foraging also surfaces in his oil paintings. Several of them are on the wall here in his studio at the Art Center. The paint is applied unevenly, thick in some places and almost rubbed away in others. And the colors are vivid and sometimes clashing. They evoke the smells and tastes of the wild plants Best finds and eats. One series of paintings captures Best impressions from a time when he harvested nuts from a ginkgo tree. He had found the tree in a cemetery near the Arlington Arts Center. Best says the nuts are one of the most noxious things he's ever encountered.
So in the middle of a cemetery, I'm squeezing these foul fruit, and there's flies everywhere because of the smell, and there's this foul liquid from me popping the fruit. And I got these seeds, and I took them home and cleaned them, and our whole apartment smells like vomit, to be honest. And then I went to eat them, and they were awful. So through all the effort I got this awful-tasting seed that I ended up throwing out, But I got a lot of work out of it. So I created this whole series. I was trying to use these kind of really discordant, unpleasant colors that clash and fight with each other to try to convey just how awful the smell of it was.
Best does much of his foraging at least every other day at Roundtree Park, a sprawling, overgrown expanse tucked away in a residential area in Falls Church.
Coming up over here is my super secret black raspberry patch, so you can't tell anyone where it is. But I brought my Tupperware. But they're tiny little things. They're really delicious.
After years of foraging, Best knows to come prepared. He wears cargo shorts, so he can fill the many pockets with scissors and baggies for the food, and sketchbooks and colored pencils for the notes and drawings. We crisscross the park as he points out Indian cucumber, May apple, elderberries, garlic mustard, and aniseed root. Best stops at a wineberry patch.
So you can see the little pods they grow in. They grow in they have like these hairs on them with some kind of resin on them. It's really sticky, and when you pick them, your hands get covered with the sappy stuff they give off. But it's worth it, usually. Even right now, my hands are all sticky. But this is the first time I've seen them open, so generally that's where I whip out the old sketchbook. And I would make a note about the progress.
Best surveys the park's flora with a forager's knowledge and an artist's eye. When a guidebook says a fruit is only edible when it's yellow, that yellow could mean something very different to an artist like Best than to the average spectator. Best sees yellow in more subtle gradations. And he stops to point out shapes that have caught his eye and bubbled up into his paintings.
That big twisting vine thing is where the inspiration for a lot of my paintings came from. It almost looks like a drawing, I think. The lines kind of etched onto that tree. It's beautiful. It's so graceful. Oh.
The shapes of vines and brambles have become Best's latest preoccupation, as the most recent paintings on the wall in his studio demonstrate. Back at the Arlington Art Center, he's using a razor blade to scrape at the surface of one of his paintings.
Well, the trick is knowing when to stop. Sometimes I go a little bit too deeply, and then I realize I should have stopped previous to that.
Best has devoted himself to following his hobby wherever it takes him, and his art. One record of that journey is now on display in Crystal City, where the Business Improvement District has blown up 7 of Best's paintings to enormous proportions and mounted them on one wall of an underpass. The gray urban setting seems like an unlikely place to find such colorful works of art, maybe as unlikely as finding a salad in an Arlington parking lot. For Metro Connection, I'm Mike Jansen.
For photos of Matthew Best's art, visit our webpage, metroconnection.org. To finish today, we shift from painting to photography. When you hear of an artist working in oil, you might imagine oil-based paint. But a current exhibit at the Corcoran Gallery of Art focuses instead on the stuff we use to make our cars go. The photography exhibit, Edward Bertinsky Oil, opened last month at the Corcoran. Oil is a substance whose photogenic qualities are rarely noticed, but critic Brett Busang says we should pay attention.
Oil drives not only our culture, but our consciousness. It informs the speed at which we accomplish daily transactions, shine light on problems, keep appointments with people who can do things for us. It touches everything in the way religion and community did back in the days when you walked to church or a town meeting. Yet our dependency on this ghastly substance has been relatively short-lived. Until the turn of the last century, we didn't really know what to do with the stuff. But with the advent of the internal combustion engine, we got on board and made up for lost time. Since then, we've created astounding infrastructures that store and contain it, arterial roadways that look like taffy pulls gone bad, appalling messes nobody has any idea how to clean up or even wants to. And while photographer Edward Bertinsky may have theories on the subject, he isn't telling. Recognizing that art need not provide solutions, he's done something almost as good. He's trained a laser-sharp eye on what we've done to our world in the name of oil. And he's done it in a way that should not only make us wonder how things got the way they are, but ask ourselves what part we might play in it. Bertinsky has traveled the world. In China, he's photographed mammoth car lots that take advantage of a country that has as much space as people. He's gaped at interchanges that resemble nothing so much as automobile amusement parks. Moseying through Azerbaijan, he trots out a bunch of rusty cylinders, workmen's hovels, and collecting pools that stink right on the page. He stumbles upon a suburb of Las Vegas and lets us contemplate it for what it is, an illusory environment complete with Disney-like canals and Spanish-style houses. He stops in Breezewood, Pennsylvania, before a babble of signage that must have an eye-searing effect on whoever is attempting to find a gas station or a place to have lunch. He's found broad humor in auto racing and grim commentary in the graveyards that will eventually contain almost every car that's been made. Bertinsky clearly intends for us to marvel at man's works, even as we might consider slapping ourselves upside the head and saying enough is enough. Like any artist, he wishes first and foremost to present us with arresting imagery. The scale he chooses, these photographs are picture window size, suits his vision of an industry that has grown much too large. His focus is harsh, but richly evocative. In some of the images, he's managed to stir the imagination as well as tap into our moral outrage. His shipbreaking series is by turns poetic and menacing, as tiny Bangladeshi workmen break apart the behemoths that once carried the lifeblood of our economy. Bertinsky claims to be apolitical. That being said, I can't imagine anybody coming away from this show somewhat more chastened than he or she expected to be. Such world-spanning despoliation is enough to make the most forgiving viewer think, if only to him or herself, that we better start walking.
Critic Brett Busang. The exhibit, Edward Bertinsky Oil, will be at the Corcoran Gallery through December 13th. And for this week, that's Metro Connection. We had extra production help from Andrew Chadwick, Jonathan Chary, Toby Schreiner, Margot Kelly, and Bill Redlin. The show's theme song, Zero Wave, was written and performed by the D.C. area band Astrolite. You can hear Metro Connection on the web if you missed a news segment or if you'd like to download a podcast. Just go to our webpage, metroconnection.org. And as always, we'd like to thank our webmaster, Jason Novak. We'd like to hear what you have to say about the show. The Metro Connection listener comment line is 202-885-8854. That's